Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight on this wet and windy evening in Sydney, but it's great to have Geoffrey Gray from Canberra, who makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He's been here a few times before, but he's here in the lead up to Anzac Day and on the occasion of the publication of Geoffrey Gray's most recent book, The War with the Ottoman Empire, which is part of a series of five books which are coming out. But this is volume two in the centenary history of Australia and the Great War, and The War with the Ottoman Empire is Geoffrey's specific contribution to that series. I'll introduce Dr. Gray briefly. He's Professor of History at the University of New South Wales in Canberra. He's the author of many books on Australian international military history, and is a member of a number of scholarly editorial boards in Australia, in Britain and in the United States. And tonight, Professor Gray is going to talk to us on the topic of Australia and the war with the Ottoman Empire. Geoffrey Gray, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jared. It's a great pleasure to be at the Sydney Institute again in somewhat adverse circumstances. I did wonder at about 3 o'clock this afternoon whether I was actually going to make it, as four flights before mine had all been cancelled. But clearly Virgin is made of indomitable stuff. The centenary of the Great War has us firmly in its grip. Governments at both federal and state level have committed eye-watering sums to commemorative and celebratory events organised around a four-year cycle, with the distinction between the commemorative and the celebratory not always well defined or clearly evident. Perhaps inevitably, most attention and effort will be devoted to events of the moment, often at a local, for which read electoral level, and with likely little medium or long-term impact. Academic commentators and others have suggested that the centenary events provide magnificent opportunities for teaching and learning about the course and conduct of the war. Such opportunities to really deepen and broaden the public's overall understanding of the Great War and its place in our history and our development as a nation across the course of the 20th century, and which might one hopes go beyond the trite birth of a nation thesis too often trotted out around 25 April each year, appears, however, to have gone begging. Much the same can be said about the efforts of Australian publishers. The immediate lead-up to the centenary saw British publishers launch a raft of serious books devoted to re-examining key questions about the outbreak of the war and its conduct in the last months of 1914. Serious books by established scholars and aimed at an intelligent general readership. Titles such as Margaret Macmillan's The War That Ended Peace, written by a Canadian based at Oxford as Warden of St Anthony's College, and Chris Clark's The Sleepwalkers, written by an Australian who was the Regius Professor of History at Cambridge, prompted spirited arguments across a wide readership, in Clark's case becoming a bestseller in Germany as well. In the United States, lacking the distraction of centenary activities for at least another 2 years, and unenthusiastic about that prospect, at least thus far, US publishers have brought out new titles on generally neglected areas, especially to do with the war in Eastern Europe and the Balkans, and the even more underappreciated activities in those parts of the Middle East not encompassed by the Dardanelles campaign. The flood of books anticipated from Australian publishers has not really happened, and the titles that have appeared have tended to conform to the usual pattern in the field. Weighty and historically largely worthless tomes by journalists, and a smaller number of much better and more scholarly research-based books, most of which will reach a much smaller audience than they deserve. The exception here to that latter category thus far has been Joan Beaumont's Broken Nation, winner, as I'm sure you know, of the Prime Minister's Prize in History for 2014. Publication these days includes much more than traditional printed pages, of course, but the plethora of websites and other digital products often prove short-lived, while their construction, while admirably democratic and available to anyone who cares to learn the fairly simple methods for their creation, is equally free of any form of review or quality assurance process. The authoritative record of Australians' participation in the Great War was provided for that generation by the massive official history edited and partly written by C.E.W. Bean. Bean shaped the way we still see the Great War and our part in it, and his influence on the writing of Australian military history of a certain kind remains pervasive to this day. Bizarrely, then, for such a central figure in the interpretation and presentation of Australia's Great War, we lack any serious body of literature on him as an historian, public intellectual, and architect of major national institutions. Indeed, despite two lengthy editions in the last 12 months, we still need a fully satisfactory biography of the man. As it is, I suspect that today Bean is more often referred to than actually read. Reading tastes, like writing styles, change over time, and the massive detail which Bean invested in his volumes is now beyond both the attention span and the knowledge base of all save a research audience. This is really only to say that Bean and his history is of its time, and that time is not ours. As a general observation, historical writing in English on the Great War suffers from a number of limitations, and possesses some defining characteristics which, taken together, have resulted in a prolonged adolescence in the genre, which has only recently, I think, begun to break down. Whilst the decades-long obsession with the Western Front in British historiography of the war has diminished understanding of other theatres and the symbiotic relationships between them, it has nonetheless greatly aided our detailed understanding of the ways in which the war was fought in that particular theatre, especially as a result of the revisionist work of the last 40-odd years. I don't know how long a body of literature has to grow before it's no longer dubbed revisionist, but most commonly this group of mostly but not exclusively British authors tends still to attract that label. Whether one fully subscribes to the notion of the learning curve and associated analysis, the fact remains that the study of the British armies in France and Belgium is immensely richer and more varied than was once the case, and it is much more difficult to advance and maintain most of the tired old clichés about British generalship, the fighting qualities of the armies, the alleged superiority of Dominion forces, and a host of other tropes that once held sway undiminished by even nodding acquaintance with fact. Some popular cultural beliefs remain impervious to reasoned, evidence-based argument. Anything to do with Douglas Haig heads the list. But there can be little question that the historical landscape is immeasurably richer and better developed than was the case when the late John Terrain began his valiant and often lonely campaign to overturn a half-century's accumulated nonsense about the reality of this war. The relentless focus on the Western Front, positive as I've suggested in its own terms, has meant, however, that other theatres and other aspects of the Great War have often not received the beneficial scrutiny of the revisionist wave. With the exception of the Dardanelles campaign of 1915, obsessively privileged in the historical writing in Australia and New Zealand, the war against the Ottoman Empire falls squarely into this category. Although this has begun to change in the last decade through the efforts of mostly younger scholars, the various theatres in the Middle East and Eastern Mediterranean remain poor cousins historiographically. Especially in the Antipodean narratives, the war is characterised by a sentimental nostalgia for the mounted units and a grossly simplified and romanticised retelling which effectively divorces those theatres of the war from their contemporary context and regards them as something other than operations of modern industrial warfare. In British accounts, Field Marshal Lord Allenby looms justifiably large, but this often results in a dismissal of his predecessor, General Sir Archibald Murray, while the Dardanelles campaign distracts historical attention from the earlier critical defence of Egypt and the canal under the first wartime GOC Egypt, General Sir John Maxwell, who, I would argue, laid the foundations on which others subsequently built. The campaign in Sinai in 1916 is usually treated in passing, and there is little attempt to see the interconnectedness of the various theatres, Egypt itself, Sinai, Mesopotamia, the Dardanelles, Salonika, the Hejaz, Palestine, not to forget the significant Russian theatres in the Caucasus and Central Asia, and of course the interplay between all of those, many of them simultaneously. The other missing dimension is consideration of the Ottomans themselves. Our knowledge of the Ottoman military is shallow and incomplete, and our understanding of the impact of the war on the Ottoman Empire's constituent societies is no better. The recent observation of a young Turkish historian that, and I quote him, "the material and environmental devastation caused by the war has never been assessed, and the war's civilian experience has still not been studied in any detail," is a judgment, I think, that could apply to no other major combatant power. There are a number of significant structural problems that help to explain this. The relevant archives have only been open to public access in the recent past. The organisation and language of the records and their finding aids reflects Ottoman practice, and both are subjects of study in their own right, while fluency in written Ottoman Turkish, a different language and a different script from modern Turkish, is fairly rare, even among Turkish historians. Military history is not a recognised field within Turkey's university system, and few historians work in it, although this is changing among a mostly younger generation of scholars, some based in Turkey and others outside the country. Nor has the relevant official history, which runs to 27 volumes, been translated into English or any other modern European language. The centenary of the Great War is of enormous significance to one national institution in this country above all others, the Australian Army. Fittingly, and as part of its contribution to marking the events concerned, successive chiefs of army agreed to underwrite a multi-volume series, The Centenary History of Australia in the Great War, which examines our part in the Great War in a fresh way for a contemporary readership. We have not set out to tell a different story. It's not counterfactuals, the Germans don't get to win. But to tell the story differently, not least through asking questions that Bean and his team did not, and through the use of archival sources, which were either unavailable to writers in the 1920s and 1930s, or, for whatever reason, were not used by them. As historians, we have also had the benefit of the literature published on the subject since Bean completed his official history in the early 1940s, and which, as I have suggested already, has greatly added to our understanding of complex issues and events. The biggest challenge for modern Australians seeking to understand the Great War and our part in it is to see those events in context. A context, moreover, which is deeply unfamiliar to our ways of thinking about ourselves and the wider world. To an extent that Australians of our time simply do not appreciate, perhaps even comprehend, this was a British nation in 1914, and its institutions, such as the army, were decidedly British in character and form. It is absolutely the case as well that participation in the Great War and its impact in subsequent decades began to undo that state of affairs. But this was a longer and a more gradual process than is sometimes understood. There is no point in judging those facts from the standpoint of modern Australia in the early 21st century, and to do so results in deeply misleading conclusions, which are frequently simply wrong. An excellent example of this is provided by the popular belief in the general incompetence of the British officer class, and in Australia in particular, by an allied belief that British authorities sought to stymie the appointment and advancement of Australian officers to positions of authority within the Australian Imperial Force. This ignores the fact that the officer corps in the British Army expanded as massively as did the wartime army, and that traditional sources, which overwhelmingly drew from the middle class and the minor rural gentry, and not the great landed families, were quickly exhausted. As a result, approximately 100,000 temporary commissions were granted in the course of the war, mostly to middle and lower middle class men, and to some of those serving in the ranks. The wartime officer corps was thus a very different entity from its Edwardian precursor, which is nonetheless, I think, in many Australian historical accounts, the benchmark against which it is judged. The popular notion that the British were hell-bent on appointing British officers of dubious ability to commands over Dominion troops is nonsense. The War Office was, in fact, very sensitive to the perception that older or unfit officers were given commands, and did its best to ensure that this was not the case. In both commanders and staffs, the Dominion forces, all of them, generally got the best available, and often in greater numbers than the territorial and new army units of the British Army, which had to take what was left. It needs to be remembered as well that at the war's beginning, there were just 6 staff-qualified officers on the Australian establishment, while the most senior officer, William Throsby Bridges, was only a major general, i.e. a divisional commander. When Bridges was killed on Gallipoli, the British appointed Major General J. Gordon Legge to succeed him, even though every senior Australian officer in the force objected that he was unfit for the command, and London overruled the commander of the Mediterranean Expeditionary Force, General Sir Ian Hamilton, who was inclined to listen to his Australian senior officers, because Legge was the Australian government's nominee. And that was the end of the discussion as far as they were concerned. As the British Empire armies expanded almost exponentially in the first 2 years of the war, the pressure to fill officer positions became even more pronounced. The Australians did not have sufficient staff officers to fill all the positions on the 1st Division headquarters in 1914. And by the early months of 1916, there were 5 infantry divisions, most of a mounted division, and 2 corps headquarters to staff, while heavy casualties had also been incurred among officers on Gallipoli. The result was frequently accelerated promotion, which might, or might not, get the desired result. British regular officers could find themselves discharging functions for which they had no experience, but at least they had a shared educational and training experience to draw upon as they did so. Serious military education and training in the Dominions before 1914 was very limited, even for regulars like Harry Chevelle, but even more so for officers of the militia. Operational experience for Dominion officers was confined to the war in South Africa, fought on a much smaller scale and with a much lower application of modern military technology. Those who survived, of course, often grew into their new roles and positions, but it was very much a case of learning while doing and of being well qualified for the job only some time after one had assumed its responsibilities. The tendency to sentimentalise the light horse, to elevate the charge at Beersheba to a level of epic it cannot sustain, and inability to see that what was important about the mounted divisions of the Egyptian Expeditionary Force was not their horses per se, but the qualities of mobility and shock action which they made possible, means that many Australians fundamentally misunderstand the campaigns in Palestine and Syria and underestimate the extent to which this was a theatre of modern war, as that term was understood in 1916-1918. In many key respects, the British war with the Ottomans confirms trends and developments in other theatres, including the Western Front. The differences between them are sometimes more apparent than real. The excessive emphasis on the mounted units in Palestine helps to obscure the fact that at its height, the EEF also contained 2 infantry corps, which disposed ultimately of 7 divisions, as opposed to the 3, ultimately 4 mounted ones, in the Desert Mounted Corps. The British deployed tanks, armoured cars, heavy artillery, chemical weapons, and air power in support of these formations. And the sense of cooperative interaction between the arms and services not only never disappeared, but became more evident as the war went on. At the tactical and operational levels, in both planning and execution, combined arms warfare was the reality of fighting in the Middle East, and manoeuvre and mobility remained key determinants of success on both sides. Our tendency to push our own views back onto earlier generations leads to other distortions as well. The so-called Gallipoli Star is a good example of the way in which we can misread the significance of events because the context is unfamiliar or unwelcome to us. The institution of the 1914 Star is a campaign award to recognise those engaged in the early weeks of fighting on the Western Front led to pressure from several dominions for its extension to recognise the early volunteers who had come forward to go to the war. And in Australia and New Zealand, this then became conflated with a desire to recognise those soldiers who had participated in the Dardanelles campaign. Powerful endorsement came from the King, George V, who wanted to grant a medal, quote, quite distinct from the 1914 decoration, while the Adjutant General in the War Office recognised readily that, and I quote, the Australians and New Zealanders will have their own way in the end. One can almost hear the exasperation coming off the page. The Dominion governments could easily have issued an award of their own devising, had that been their intention. The real point is that the medal, which would ultimately become the 1914-15 Star, for which eligibility would include Canadians, Newfoundlanders and Indians, as well as Australians and New Zealanders, was to be awarded within the imperial system. And it is clear that this form of imperial recognition, on a par with that afforded the mostly British regular army recipients of the 1914 medal, was uppermost in many Dominion minds. They sought validation, but validation within the empire. Wars rarely end neatly, and great power wars almost never do so. The passage of the armistice in November 1918 marked merely the end of a phase of the conflict, albeit a major one. In significant ways, the Great War served a similar function for major and minor powers elsewhere. For countries as different as Ireland and Russia, the fighting continued into the early 1920s, while the consequences of that were felt for decades beyond. The Ottomans were faced with partition and dismemberment under the terms of the Treaty of Sevres in 1920, but the outcome of the Turkish War of Independence saw that position abandoned and substantially revised with the Treaty of Lausanne in 1923. One might argue that the Turks were the only winners among the losing nations, and their outcome looks a lot better in hindsight than those accorded to such ostensible winners as the Czechs and the Poles. The Ottomans entered the Great War because they feared the consequences of not doing so. Their involvement on the side of the Central Powers was not inevitable, and the diplomatic record of the decade before the war began shows regular attempts by Constantinople to secure an alliance with Britain in 1908, 1911, and again in 1913. Moves which were largely frustrated by Russian geostrategic and French financial interests. German intentions towards the Ottoman Empire in the years before 1914 were not benign either, a fact not lost on the Ottoman government. But their resultant diplomatic isolation offered them few viable options as the international order deteriorated around them. Despite the generally poor press that they attract, the government of the Committee of Union and Progress, the CUP, known best to history as the Young Turks, was bent upon the modernisation of the Ottoman state and the preservation of the Ottoman Empire, and participation in the Great War doomed both to failure. It seems not unreasonable to ponder what the modern Middle East, and much of the world's history since at least 1945, might look like now, Had the Ottomans maintained the neutrality they announced in August 1914? Thank you.
So, thanks to Professor Gray. As I said, Geoffrey Gray's book, The War with the Ottoman Empire, is available here tonight, and I have some copies. I think it's $59.95, but at the Sydney Institute you can get it for the special price of $60, since we don't have any change in this very difficult weather. So now we come to questions and discussions, and we've got till about the top of the hour, so we've got plenty of time. So just take us back to 1914. At the end of your talk, you mentioned that the Ottoman Empire had declared neutrality in August 1914. When the first AIF left Australia to go to the Northern Hemisphere, as you know, they thought they were taking on Imperial Germany, but they end up in the Dardanelles, and they end up fighting the Ottoman Empire. So what was the kind of... I mean, what was known about the Ottoman Empire in Australia in late 1914, early 1915, and how did it come that instead of going to the Western Front, we end up in the Dardanelles?
I'll take the second part of the question first. We end up being put ashore in Egypt for a number of reasons, and it's early in the war, so the archival record on this is a little bit fragmentary. It's not as complete as we might hope. The primary reason was that the Canadians were already in Britain on Salisbury Plain. They had taken up most of the temporary accommodation that had been constructed. It was mostly tents, and the winter of 1914-15 was the vilest on record for some time. The Canadians came down with massive waves of influenza and other disease as a result of the cold, wet conditions. The training grounds were full. There seemed no point in trying to stuff more men into an area that was already clearly not coping. So the decision was made, put them in Egypt. There are plenty of training grounds there, they thought, although they had to rush very quickly to build more accommodation and facilities against the onset of the summer and the ferocious heat. There's also a suggestion, which we can never quite pin down, that at least in some parts of London there may have been a thought that by putting these large numbers of European troops, and they were troops in name only, most of them had received only the most rudimentary levels of training, but to put them in Egypt would help to deter any unrest either in Egypt itself or on the western frontier of Egypt, where the Senussi were restive and would indeed come into open rebellion in late 1914, encouraged by Ottoman and German officers who were sent to direct their efforts. And there does seem to be some suggestion that although these soldiers wouldn't have been much use had there been a serious Ottoman attack upon the canal in late 1914, as there was indeed in early 1915, they were there as a sort of deterrent presence. Large numbers of Europeans in uniform would help to keep the lid on Egypt. Lord Kitchener was desperately concerned that Egypt would blow up. There had been restive mutterings and nationalist agitation, particularly in Cairo and Alexandria, for some time. Kitchener, of course, was an old Egypt hand. Maxwell, the GOC, who Kitchener sent back out to Egypt when the war began, was also an old Egypt hand who'd spent much of his career there. He spoke the language, he knew the players, he had good relations in the court, and he and Kitchener had served as junior officers together in Egypt first in 1882, so they knew each other very well. What did Australians know about the Ottoman Empire? Probably not much, and most of it not accurate. There was a generalised belief amongst Europeans that Turkey, or the Ottoman Empire, of course, was the sick man of Europe. There was a general sense that they had been badly beaten in the Balkan Wars of 1912 and 1913, which was true as far as it went, but concealed a number of important qualifiers there about the quality of Ottoman troops, particularly on the defensive, which most Western observers seem not to have noticed, and which would prove an expensive lesson when it came time to invade the Gallipoli Peninsula. The intelligence that the British Army had on the Ottoman military specifically was about half a decade old. As I say, it didn't pay much note to the experience in the Balkan Wars. It overlooked the fact that the Ottoman officer corps was a deeply, recently experienced military, which had more experience of operations under near-contemporary conditions than any of the other major combatant armies would have. And the British Army hadn't fought a war since South Africa a decade and a half earlier. The Prussian-German military hadn't fought anywhere since the Wars of Unification in the early 1870s, and so on. Those powers that had experience were often in colonial wars, which was not a very useful pointer to what would happen. So, in that sense, all of the British armies, plural, that take part in the campaign in the Dardanelles in 1915 woefully underestimate the quality of their Ottoman opponents. It comes as a very nasty surprise when they find that they're not, in fact, a bunch of bashy bazooks, as Haig is alleged to have told Brudenell White the following year when the Australians got to France. And if you go through the records and you're reading the documents, you will find, and this goes on well into about 1917, until finally the penny seems to drop. If anything good happens on the Ottoman side, it must have been planned and led by the Germans. Now, there aren't actually that many Germans with the Ottoman army. They do fulfil a number of key posts, that's quite true, but there aren't that many of them. And in fact, the key to Ottoman resilience is the quality and leadership of their commanders and staffs, who have been trained in a German model staff system, which was reformed by an earlier German advisory mission in the 1880s. It's not Germans per se that bring about the successes that the Ottomans achieve, but German methodology, rigorously applied, certainly has something to answer for there.
Thanks. Don't stand in front of the camera, folks. So, where's the question here? Yeah.
Thank you for the talk. I just was wondering if there's anything you can see improving in Anzac history being taught in high schools and how that could be improved if there is anything.
You think the teaching of Anzac history could be improved in high schools?
I suspect the teaching of history generally could be improved in high schools. But I have to say I don't think that's the fault of teachers. I've done some work with history teachers over the last year or two, specifically within the context of Australian military history and the national curriculum and all those sorts of ideas. They get it. They understand. And they're as frustrated as people at the university level are with the general lack of underpreparedness that they see in students coming to take humanities subjects generally and history subjects specifically. My personal view is that if we want to really change that situation, we need to do two things. We need to pay more attention to literacy and numeracy at primary school, and high school teachers will tell you that the real damage, the rot has set in before they ever see students in secondary education, and they're having to do remedial work in that. But the other thing I think that would make a big difference is if we went back to an older system which said, if you're going to teach a subject, I don't care what the subject is, mathematics, history, English, you have to have a major in that, in a degree. So if you're going to be a history English teacher, you need majors in a BA in history and English, not majors in educational theory in a bachelor's of education or now a master's of education, which is where trainee teachers are being pushed, which whatever good it may or may not do in terms of teaching you methods in classrooms is no substitute for subject matter expertise. And one of the biggest complaints and requests that I see from history teachers regularly, I get calls from people who I've never clapped eyes on, who'll say, oh, you taught one of my students a couple of years ago. He was at, ex-high school or whatever. I've got to teach whatever it is. What should I be reading? And it's a very simple, very sensible question. And the resources, as we all know, of many school libraries and so on are not really up to keeping abreast of what comes out or of deciding what's really worth reading and basing lesson plans on from what is not. And they need help, and they readily admit that. And I think there's a failure, frankly, in many tertiary-level historians in the universities who simply don't want to engage with that. And I think that's wrong. I think we have an obligation to engage with that and to assist the educational process at other levels to bring all three levels into some sort of alignment, some sort of continuum. Then if we're not getting the results we want, we have a right to complain, but not until.
Right down the back, Fred, then we come here, yeah?
You mentioned the British attitude to the Ottomans. I couldn't help feeling when you said that, that maybe there is a great power attitude to non-Western countries. And the British to the Ottomans, the Americans to the Vietnamese in the war in South Vietnam, the attitude of the Americans to the Iraqis in the Middle East. This, as a former military officer, you'd hear the Americans talking about they're a bunch of people in pajamas with flip-flops or they're a bunch of towel heads. And my question is, I know the Australian attitude was very different in Vietnam. They respected the people they were up against. And it seemed to me that perhaps the Australians respected the Turks much more than the British did. Would you care to comment on that?
This question is of the attitude of the British to the Turks and then of the Australians to the Turks.
I don't know that I'd go too far in building up Australian attitudes. They were very much of their time. They shared the same sorts of British race nationalist views that the Empire shared in common. You've only got to go and read Susan Brugger's excellent little book on Australians in Egypt to see just how deep the contempt for natives ran amongst Australian soldiers. And for a while, at least, that seems to have carried over into their view about the Turks. Remember, Turks is a modern misnomer. Many of the units they encountered were Arabs, just like the Egyptians, whom they despised so openly were. That attitude, interestingly, also appears in the British High Command, and indeed amongst some of the German advisers. Kress von Kressenstein always makes a distinction between the Turkish divisions of his army and the Arab ones. He has no time for the Arabs, which is usually very unfair. The British tend to take the same view. They dismiss the Arab divisions, often against the evidence that these are the very same people they're facing in the lines who are holding them scoreless and inflicting heavy casualties. I think the attitudes in these things, yes, the great power thing is obviously a part of it. But across the course of the 20th century, I think there are broader cultural issues that are involved there. And all the examples you gave in your question are all cases where the dominant imperial power, Britain or the United States or whatever, knows very little about the culture, deploys very few people who speak the language, and therefore, not really very surprisingly, gets a lot of it wrong. That I don't find surprising at all.
At the start of the World War I, what was the practical relationship between the Australian and New Zealand defence forces or their armies? Was there much collaboration?
Again, start of the war in 14, what was the practical relationship between the Australian and the New Zealand defence forces?
There was some, but it was fairly rudimentary. I mean, you've got to remember that in 1914, the staffs and the departments are tiny. All the departments of federal government in this country are tiny. That's partly a resource question. The federal government doesn't have a really large tax take. Income tax is still a state function and will remain so until the Second World War. So their resources and means are very limited. There is some discussion between the Australian and New Zealand staffs starting in about 1912 about what might happen in the event of a general war and assuming that the two governments chose to send forces to it. Out of the 1911 Imperial Conference, which is a terribly important event in London, there is a general understanding arrived at that patterning the armies of the Dominions alongside that of Britain makes good sense against the potentiality that they may all have to take the field together. But there is equally explicit acknowledgement, and this thing is very fully minuted. It runs to about 70 pages. You can read the whole of the exchange between all sides in the military talks. There is very explicit acknowledgement by the British that they cannot compel a single volunteer from any of the dominions to come and fight on behalf of Britain. That is a decision which will be made by those governments. The war declaration power resides with the king. But that's all he can do. He can declare war, but he can't compel the dominion governments to field forces should they choose not to do so. Now, the cultural reality of 1914 is, of course, that it was pretty widely assumed with justice that they would do so. But the British make it very, very clear in 1911 that they know they cannot compel it, and they're not trying. They're not playing games on this one. They're taking sensible precautions, of which the talks with the New Zealanders are a part, to try and align those nascent armies in such a way that if they do all have to be fielded together, they're actually going to be able to talk to each other, operate on similar assumptions, have trained similarly, hopefully be equipped more or less along the same lines and more or less with the same weapons to simplify logistics, supply and other arrangements. That's pretty much how it works, with a couple of exceptions.
Jeff, I'd like to ask a question about sitting down to write the volume of the Centenary First World War history. What sort of large decisions did you make at the beginning, and was it in some ways a bit of a burden because there's a huge tradition there? Did you feel you had to struggle against that tradition, I guess, at Bean starts? Did you also feel yourself having to struggle against what most people would knee-jerk think about the subject? Or you were able simply to approach it fresh and think, no, I'll just start all over and go ahead and set the story straight.
Your writing approach to writing this history of...
That's a good question, and there are a number of parts in the answer to it. I very deliberately at the outset organised the series in a way that would fly against the usual ways in which these things are done. So there's no standalone volume on Gallipoli. There's no standalone volume on the Western Front. The first volume deals with the Flying Corps and military aviation, because of course the Flying Corps was part of the army, and aviation comes into its own in the Great War and has important implications going forward. The second volume was very deliberately constructed as the war with the Ottoman Empire, and so that it involves the Dardanelles, Sinai, Palestine, Syria, and takes a more than sideways glance at the other theatres, the defence of Egypt, Mesopotamia, the Russian efforts in the Caucasus, and Salonika, all of which feed into and shape and influence the way that happened. The third volume is the war with the Germans. That starts in 1914 with the great and urgent imperial duty of taking the German colonies to our near north, and then, of course, segues into a lengthy discussion of the war on the Western Front. The fourth volume is the war at home, and it deals with the politics, social issues, and war economy, a largely untouched subject, certainly by modern historians, and actually has three authors, because that's such a complex volume that no single historian could hope to be across all of them. And the last volume is a book on the AIF as an organisational study, how it fitted together, what it did, why it did it, and so on. So there was a very deliberate model there that said, we're not just going to have a volume on Gallipoli, and we're not just going to have a volume on Palestine. That misses so much, to my way of thinking. And the further I got into writing the book, the more it seemed to me that I'd been right about that, that you miss the links and the connections if you separate those all out and treat them standalone in isolation. Those who know me well probably would tell you that I'm not generally afflicted by self-doubt, and I didn't regard taking this on as a struggle. I thought it was a magnificent opportunity, and I was very lucky to be able to pull together a group of historians who thought so too, and who I've now read four of the volumes. Volume 3 is in print and bind, volume 4 is in first pages, and I have the manuscript of volume 5 in my briefcase to read in the hotel tonight, or to start. And they have absolutely risen to the broad guidelines, and they were always very broad guidelines that I gave them. In my specific volume, I wanted to do something that I thought badly needed doing, and that was to set the story of Australian involvement in the various campaigns in the Eastern Mediterranean into their wider imperial context. And I say at some point in the introduction that some readers are probably going to be annoyed by this, because many of the voices that I use are British officers. There's a very good reason for that. They ran the thing. And if you want to understand what was done and why it was done, you need to understand the decisions and the thinking processes behind the orders that were made. Until 1917, no Australian officer functions at the operational level of command. Simple fact. They have no input into the decision-making and deliberative processes at that level. No Dominion government influences or shapes the strategic direction of the war at any stage. Simple fact. If we want to understand why Australian soldiers did certain things or were used in certain ways, then we need to understand that higher level context, and that is necessarily, much of the time, British. I make the point as well in the book that, and it's part of my remarks this evening, British officers came in all shapes and sizes. Some of them were admirable characters, highly proficient, even talented. Some of them were completely useless, and everything in between those two points of the spectrum. Funnily enough, Australian officers tend to conform to exactly the same characteristics, which is something else that we tend not to notice when we get into celebratory mode about this. But those were the sorts of broad ideas that I had, and then I hope, like any good historian, I went and buried myself in the archives and went where the evidence took me. The great thing about doing this series now is that virtually all the papers of senior officers that are extant are in public collections. That wasn't true in the 20s and 30s. It wasn't even true, for example, when Alec Hill wrote his biography of Harry Chevelle. I went back and was, because I read the Chevelle papers, and I went back and checked what Alec had done with them. And I saw at one point I was reading something, and he said, unfortunately, Chevelle's letter to Chetwood on this matter is lost. No, it isn't. It's in the Chetwood papers in the Imperial War Museum. But they hadn't come into public access when Alec was doing that work in the late 60s and early 70s. So we're immeasurably better off. Probably the single greatest coup for that volume came very late in the day, where I was already well into to the writing. And as at least I do, I think, I suspect military historians do this a bit, you're writing along and you're coming to a discussion, and I needed to just think, okay, I was talking about Maxwell and his early command in Egypt. What rank was he? Just couldn't call him up. And somehow I'd put in something into, well, my Google foo was particularly strong that evening, I don't know, but up came this thing saying, General Sir John Maxwell, papers. No, there aren't any papers, sir. General Sir John Maxwell, papers. There aren't any papers. I know there aren't any papers because I asked the question in London, and they put me onto an admirable online guide called A to A, Access to Archives, which lists all the personal papers of significant or less significant historical figures held in British public collections anywhere in the UK. They don't pick up collections of papers in the research library at the university, at Princeton University in the United States. So there are no Maxwell papers? Well, there are no Maxwell papers on A to A, but there certainly are 20 boxes of them in the Firestone Library at Princeton. So I very quickly got me on a plane and went to New York, and there was a great mass of his correspondence with all sorts of people, which supplemented what were often very patchy records for the very early part of the war, late 1914, early 1915, where most of the war officers' attention, of course, was on France and raising new divisions and getting them into the line against the Germans. And because of the personal relationship between Maxwell and Kitchener, which I've alluded to already, they clearly conducted a lot of their business in demi-official or unofficial correspondence rather than in formal staff processes between Cairo and London. So if you go to the files in Kew looking for that stuff, it's not there. But it is in Maxwell's papers, or at least enough of it to make a substantial difference to the story.
So going back to your point about Britain running this, why would the British have decided to engage the Ottoman Empire in, particularly in 1915, rather than focusing on the Western Front?
Part of it comes down to, and again, I think that I've discussed this in the book, one needs to be very careful of the rather crude simplification of Easterners and Westerners in terms of strategic direction